This is episode 10 of A Duff Said. I'm your host, Duff Tyler. Thank you so much for hitting the play button. I want to start off this edition by talking about life. Specifically, that guy you know at the office who, just like you, is stuck in a crappy situation and there doesn't seem to be a silver lining in sight, but somehow he's the one that finds his way out of it, gets a better job. All of a sudden, he's making more money. Life is just swell. And then he just goes out and decides to top all that. He gets a hot wife, great car, great house. Everything is going great for this guy. And you never hear the end of it because people won't stop talking about it. It's in your face nonstop. It's living in your head rent-free. Well, that's what Tiger fans have had to deal with for the last couple of years watching Justin Verlander on the mound for the Astros. Now, you may recall, it was around this same time a couple of years ago, back in 2017, when he left for the Astros in a trade, and suddenly, he got even better on the mound for the Astros. He got himself a World Series ring, he's still living it up with Kate Upton, and this year, he's competing with his own teammate, Gerrit Cole, for the American League Cy Young Award. Remember when we had that 5 years ago here in Detroit when we had Verlander and we had Max Scherzer? Well, those days here in Detroit, they're long gone. In fact, right now for the Tigers, they can't do anything right, even when they're trying to do wrong. Now, for the longest time, it was a given that this year's team was going to be bad. In fact, for a while there, we thought it was going to be historically bad. Now, when they were the first team in baseball to recently reach 100 losses this season, we all figured that, well, the one bright side to this big pile of garbage was at least they were guaranteed the first pick in next year's Major League Baseball draft. Well, all of a sudden, they've decided that they can't even tank right. Yeah, they've actually won a couple of games in the last week. They beat the A's, they beat the Yankees, two teams competing for the postseason. And Baltimore, meanwhile, has said, hold my crab cakes, because suddenly they've gone on a skid, and they're now catching up to the Tigers for the worst record in baseball, and now this weekend series between the Tigers and the Orioles is the ultimate race to the bottom. Somebody has to lose this series. And if you're the Tigers, don't try. Don't show up now. Why start now? Do what got you to this point, fellas. Keep being you, keep being what we thought you were, and go get that worst record in baseball. We believe! Now, as you might expect, it's been a miserable year for Tiger fans. And it only keeps getting worse by Verlander. Now, you may recall a couple of weeks ago, he was on the hill in Toronto for the Astros, and he notched his third career no-hitter against the Blue Jays. Now, not only was that a special notch in his Hall of Fame career, it was also a special moment for one of my former college classmates.
Again, the 3-2 pitch. Bounding ball down to third. Toro's got it. On to first. In time! Justin Verlander holds his arms into the air, pumps his fist, elated! He becomes the fourth pitcher in Major League history to fire three or more no-hitters. He's the first in big league history to do it in the same venue against the same team. He's done it on this Sunday afternoon in Toronto, Ontario.
That voice you just heard belongs to Ben Wagner of the Blue Jays radio network on Sportsnet 590 The Fan in Toronto. Now, Ben was one of my old college classmates at Indiana State University. Now, I first met Wags, as we affectionately called him, 20 years ago. He and I were radio broadcast partners for basketball and baseball games at Indiana State. Now, after he graduated college, Ben went on to have a successful career as a play-by-play announcer for minor league baseball out on the East Coast. Last year, the Blue Jays called him up, gave him a shot at the play-by-play duties for their radio network, and as you just heard, he got to call the first no-no in his major league career. Now, that is no doubt going to be one of many great calls that he makes throughout his time as a Major League Baseball play-by-play announcer. So, mad props to my old friend. March on. Now, this show features another fellow Sycamore classmate of mine. Now, you may recall a few weeks ago on the show, I brought up this topic. Here's a story for you. I am not making this up. I had a friend in college who, when he was in high school, he was legally blind, but he was a place kicker for his high school football team, and he wasn't bad. We were all shocked when he told us this story, and we all thought it was a joke. You're not a high school place kicker. So he goes and shows us the videos, and we see all these news stories about him being a place kicker, and there was one in particular where the newscaster comes back on, and he says, well, you know how people are waving their arms at the end of the game to distract the kicker? Well, he can't see them, so it doesn't bother him. That guy is Scott Reese. Now, Scott and I also called baseball games on the radio at Indiana State University. But before that, he was the place kicker for his high school football team at Griffith High School in northwestern Indiana back in 1995. Now, as you just heard, Scott is legally blind. And in college, yes, we also had a nickname for him too. We called him Scotty Eyes. And he often referred to himself as the blind assassin. Now, all jokes aside, because I want to make this very clear, that's just the kind of guy Scott is. Scott never wanted to be treated differently than anyone else. He did want to be defined by his disability. I just called him up from his home in Indianapolis. He joins us now on the phone. Scott, it is a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for making the time.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You got it, my friend. It's always good to talk to you. Now, I want to go back to those days because, like I just said, you never wanted to be defined by your disability, and you were always telling us, hey, you know, don't treat me differently than anyone else. But when we're talking about high school football, that is a sport where vision is crucial. So what motivated you to want to play high school football, and ultimately, what got you interested in wanting to be a place kicker?
Well, as far as playing high school football, growing up in Griffith, Indiana, is pretty much what every boy, you know, boy wanted to do growing up. The team was very popular, very successful, especially back in the mid-90s. It was nothing to play in front of crowds of 10,000 fans at home. And, you know, just the prestige of being able to play a sport like that. For me personally, because I know one of the things that, you know, that people have always asked is what made me decide to be a kicker. Well, my first 2 years on the team, my son is an offensive lineman, and you were right, sight is obviously a big thing. And as hard as I tried to play as an offensive tackle, I just wasn't that good. You know, I could go and easily see a guard or a tackle in front of me. But if it came time to go and try to block a linebacker, certain plays you might have to try to go and get two guys during the course of the play. But yeah, I could easily, like I said, go and get a tackle or a guard. But then when that linebacker shoots in, I wasn't able to attack them. So I got very limited playing time. You know, my first 2 years, we had a heck of a team. My junior year, we lost by a point after the last second against Tipton at semi-state, and we were heavy favorites going into the season to go down to sales. Maybe that didn't happen, but I just didn't want my senior year to feel wasted and just standing on the sidelines. So 3 days or so after we got knocked out of the playoffs my junior year, I asked my head coach, I said, you know, I got a far-out question for you. Would you ever consider letting me kick? And he said, yeah, I'm not going to tell you no in terms of what it is that you want to do. So I went to kicker's camp. When the weather started warming up in between the end of my junior year and the springtime, right before my senior year, I was also on the track team, wasn't very good, but I started to practice outside.
Now, Scott, whenever I tell people your story, I always get the same question. How do you do it? And I think kicking an extra point is a lot harder than people might realize because you have to have all 11 guys in sync at the same time in order to pull it off. I mean, you've got the long snap, you've got the holder that's got to put the ball down just right in order for you to get it through the uprights, and then you got all the guys up front that are trying to keep you from getting blocked. So take me through the process. How did you make it work?
Well, first of all, I got to give a lot of huge thanks to my holder who started off playing on defense. He was a safety, and then also he became the quarterback after I had graduated back to coaching. But Shane Radke, I give him all the credit in the world. One of the first things that we did, because at night, there's no way I'm seeing the teaser black. There's no way I was going to be able to see that. He and our head coach had contacted the IHSAA and asked them if there was any way that they could spray paint the tee fluorescent orange so I could see it at night, and the IHSAA agreed. So that helped out. When it was time for me to go, Shane would either say something like go or hit, and I would know that that was my cue to go and move towards the ball. Went to DePaul University for kickers. Camp had a lot of training and a lot of support from people that I had gone to camp with, so that definitely helped. And it was just like a repetitive thing, and even watching some videos from guys like Ray Guy, who used to play for the Raiders, guys like the Toe Groza. Just watching different instructional videos and, you know, kind of using my imagination. I was told there was a sweet spot on the ball, and so I'd always aim for that when I kicked. And so a lot of it was just repetition. And I'm going to be honest, there were plenty of times where I would kick, and I would have to gauge my teammates' reactions, or if I'm playing at home, to gauge the reactions of the crowd to know whether or not I actually made the extra point.
I remember watching the tapes from those days, and one of the first things that stood out was your holder said in the beginning, you were constantly booting his hands and kicking his arms when you guys were trying to get this thing down. How long did it take you two to find a rhythm?
Gosh, I want to say probably about a week or two. Yeah, it was hard for him, and again, I give him all the credit in the world for being so patient with me, too. I'd say about a week or two. To get that going, because of course when I first started doing this, I wasn't having anybody hold the ball for me. I was kicking it off of a tee, and the tee was a lot different than the tee that you use as an extra point kicker is similar, I call it like a black brick or a black box or whatever. When I started out, I was using the regular kickoff tee. That way I didn't have to deal with, you know, somebody holding a football. I could just go and set it up on there and go kick it and do, you know, what I wanted with it. So obviously that was a big change. And then, of course, having an offensive line come at you, it took me a while. I remember I was pretty much given the starting kicker's job before the season started, and, of course, I messed that up. First couple preseason games, well, Orama preseason game, and then a scrimmage before that. Wasn't too swift, like I said, when I had somebody come at me. The first regular season game of the week, though, we were up, I think it was like 47-20 or something like that, around there. And I was finally worked into a game, and then actually, the first three games during the regular season that I kicked, I did not miss an extra point.
So you go through practice, and you get everything down, but then it comes time to do it in an actual game. What do you remember about that first time that you lined up for an extra point?
I remember being extremely nervous because I had, like I said, I had never faced, 11 guys charging at you trying to block the kick. The first couple times that I missed, it was because I just didn't get enough lift off on the ball and the other team was able to go and, you know, and block the kick. When I got to do it for the first time at home during an actual game that mattered, not going to lie, I was a nervous wreck. But it was awesome hearing a very loud ovation for me when I got onto the field. And I remember a starting quarterback, and I'm going to clean up the language, obviously, but he pretty much, you know, pumped me up and said, all right, Reese, this is your time. You better go get it. So, you know, I knew there were people counting on me, and luckily, when I made that first kick, in fact, it was against Hammond High, I can tell you it did feel like an enormous weight finally got lifted off my shoulders.
We're talking with Scott Reese, a blind man from Indianapolis, who in his high school football days in the mid-90s was a place kicker for his high school football team. Now, if you're curious, Scott was 12 of 18 on extra point attempts. And Scott, it didn't take long for people to notice after you got that first one that this wasn't a gimmick. You were actually pretty good at this.
I remember being in the locker room changing after a game, and I overheard our head coach talking to one of his assistants. He's like, "You believe this?" Like, at week three, he's like, "Retail has missed an extra pull all year." And it was kind of funny, after week one, seeing my name in the paper as one of the leading scorers in our area. Had a good chuckle on that.
Was there ever a time when you felt pressured by this? And by that, I mean, you don't want people to see you as the blind kicker on your high school football team. You just want people to see Scott Reese and say, "That's the kicker for our team." You just want to be one of the guys. So was there ever a time when you felt like you were pressured into thinking, "I can't make mistakes at this"?
Yeah, and it was all self-made. Nobody outside of me caused me to feel any angst or anxiety, however you want to call it. There was one game. I remember, in fact, it was homecoming. ESPN was there. Scouts were there. And it, I'm going to be honest, it was the worst game I had ever played. I wound up missing, I think it was like my first three kicks, something like that. To that end, yeah, there was some pressure. Again, that was what I did. I don't think anything else other than, yeah, for sure I wanted to be considered no different than anybody else, but did the thought of being somebody who could inspire other people who have faced something similar, did it cross their mind? Of course it did. Obviously, to go and feel at times where I was a complete outcast and to feel like, okay, I'm finally being accepted. You know, the first couple of years I was on the team, yeah, I wasn't happy with my performance, but it was one of those where, hey, I'm cool. I'm just happy to be here, be a part of a team. Because obviously I didn't get to do that when I was younger. You know, people, when they're younger, they play Little League or they play club soccer or whatever. Nobody wanted to give me a chance. I finally was able to, you know, find somebody who had a heart big enough to give me that opportunity. But, you know, as amongst my peers, I really didn't feel like I got that respect until my senior year. And then, obviously, a lot of different things finally flowed into my direction.
How did it feel to finally earn that respect? Because unlike some of the stories we've seen in recent years, where you do have kids with disabilities that get into that last game of the season, their coaches decide they're going to play them, and they make a deal with the other team that they'll let them score a touchdown or get a basket and have one of those truly inspirational, heartwarming moments. And those are great stories, don't get me wrong, but you're the kicker all season long, and week by week, your name is showing up in the stat sheets. You're getting your name in the paper just like the other guys who are doing the job for Griffith High School. But now, all of a sudden, in the hallways and in the locker room, you're finally gaining their acceptance. How did that feel?
I think first and foremost, I felt like I finally earned the letter. Even though I didn't get much playing time, sophomore and junior years. In fact, I did not letter my, I remember I didn't letter my sophomore year, but did my junior year. Kind of had a little bit of an empty feeling that I had lettered because I really didn't feel like I had earned it. And then obviously my senior year, I had played more than enough to where I felt I had finally earned that letter. You know, it felt great in terms of, again, just the respect factor. I understand that respect is something that's not just given to you, and it shouldn't be. It's something that is earned. Obviously, when you're, no matter how hard you work, amongst your teammates especially, if you're not playing that much, you're not contributing that much, even though some will say, well, yeah, when you practice, you're getting everybody prepped for, you know, the next game or whatever. But in my case, I finally felt like I had earned my place there. And it felt, you know, like I said, it felt wonderful to be able to finally felt like I had done something.
So you gain their acceptance at Griffith High School, and suddenly you're a celebrity in the hallways. But when you get to Indiana State University, it's a much different story, because for the longest time, you would tell me and some of the other guys in college that you were the place kicker for your high school football team, and we all thought you were full of crap. We did not believe that for a second, because we all thought you were just pulling our leg, you were exaggerating on this. And like I've touched on a few times in this conversation, this all happened in the mid-90s. Now, the internet was a thing back then, but it wasn't what it's like today. There was no social media, no Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and there was no YouTube or any of the other video streaming services. Back in those days, you had to go to the tape to get proof on this. So one night, Scott takes me and a few other guys to his dorm room, pops in some tapes, and suddenly we're taken to Griffith High School and we're seeing Scott making all these kicks. It was unbelievable. Our jaws hit the floor. Now, this wasn't just the Indiana station, Scott, that were doing these stories. Like you said, ESPN came and did a story on you, and there were other organizations that did news reports on you. And I'll never forget the one from the guy who I think may have been from the BBC. Dude had a thick British accent, and he goes, "Scott Reese is legally classified as blind, but this bloke can put it through the uprights." And we were like, oh my God, you were telling the truth. You really were a place kicker for your high school football team. Now, going back to your days at Griffith, what was that exposure like for you?
It had its advantages and, or I should say, fun times and not so fun times. I'll start off with a negative part because I like to finish in a positive way. There were plenty of times where I would be at school, and, you know, if you're going to be on TV, you want to dress a certain way, you want to look a certain way, all those things. And it'd be nothing, you know, I just wear a, during the week, a t-shirt and a pair of jeans. And all of a sudden, I would have somebody from the media show up without my knowing it. And, hey, we're here to do an interview. And it happened a lot more than you think. I remember my sister and I had a conversation. She had already moved out, but, you know, she was, had graduated a couple years older than I had. But she had paid a visit to our house. And I remember her, you know, I come in after practice one day, and she could tell I was not in, I don't say in a bad mood, but I was more or less exhausted. And she goes, "Let me guess, another media interview." I go, "Yeah, I've had three of them today." I would have liked to, you know, radio doesn't bother me any, but for TV, obviously, there's a certain image you want to project and all those things. And then on the positive side, yeah, I was able to absolutely go out and tell my story. The other thing I was going to say on the negative side, too. Whenever you have that many people doing interviews with you, you always want to come up with a different way to answer a question. So at times it was difficult for me. I was sitting there going, okay, I've got this question asked to me a million times, seemingly. How do I answer it differently to make it where it doesn't sound, you know, almost like a Scott Reese cliche-ish answer? On the positive side, let's get back to that. Again, I was able to tell my story. I was able to share it with as many people as possible. I know for a fact that I was able to inspire some folks because I had gotten, for lack of a better term, some fan mail that was sent to me either at my parents or over at the high school. You know, from a parent, sometimes even from kids. Some of them were visually impaired. Some of them weren't. They were, you know, kids might have been going through some different things, and folks would reach out to me. So that definitely meant a lot to me. And so, yeah, on that side, for sure, there was definitely some positives to it.
When you look back on that time in your life, what are you most proud of? Was it the way that you were able to inspire others, the success that you did have as a kicker, or was it the major award you received from Evander Holyfield?
Wow. Boy. I try not to ever look at things from an individual standpoint. I just wanted to do my job and contribute as much as I could. So honestly, in the past, you know, it's been less than 95 was the last, my one and only year as a kicker. I haven't really thought about that much. I would say it's a toss-up just because in both ways, manners, they were reflections of my being able to inspire folks. the award now that you're talking about is just called Courage in Sports, but it used to be called the Arena Awards for Courage in Sports. So I honestly didn't think I was going to win it. I was put in, I had won the Junior Division Award. I was put in categories with kids who had cancer. There was another kid who was a rollerblader, skated competitively, and had issues with an aortic valve. All sorts of different things that I'm sitting there going, you know, this kid's health was on the line. Mine really wasn't. So there was a certain amount of pride that went into that, and then being able to have more people see it again. And again, the fan mail and all those things also confirmed to me that there were people that were inspired by what it was that I was able to do. So to answer your question, I would say a little bit of both, actually.
I want to take a look now at where things are today, Scott, because back in the mid-90s, it might have seemed a little far-fetched to have a legally blind kid be the place kicker for his high school football team. But then you fast forward to where we are today, things have changed a lot. You now have young girls and young women who are competing as the place kickers on their high school and college football teams. You have people with disabilities taking part in a number of different sports. In fact, I just saw a story recently where a guy out in California who had no arms won a triathlon. When you reflect on what you did back then and you take a look at where things are today, what goes through your mind?
Definitely a sense of pride. As a matter of fact, I'll go back to high school a little bit. This is probably about 10 years ago or so, but I remember, and I can't remember the kid's name. I didn't coach him or anything. But there was actually a kid from Griffith who had played offensive line, and I was told his vision was a lot worse than what mine was. Unfortunately, I wasn't living in Indiana at the time. I would have obviously loved to have been able to reach out and say that kid had visited in person. But you look at somebody like him. You look at and I can't remember the gentleman's name, but there was a couple of years ago, there was a long snapper over at USC that was completely blind, and he got into a game. You look at somebody, I can't think of her name now. But anyway, she's a world-famous surfer, and she's got both of her arms missing. I'm just proud of the fact that people are a lot more open-minded about things than they might have been 20 years ago. I remember there were coaches of mine, you know, assistants. Luckily, they were only there for a year. But they had tried talking my head coach into cutting me off the team. And my coach would not do it. He said, you know, Scott's went out and done everything I've ever asked of him. I'm not going to go and get rid of him. I'm very proud of the fact that you are definitely seeing a lot more open-mindedness. And then, obviously, the kicking position obviously is a position that I don't think gender really matters, or a limitation, as I call it. Like I had, as long as somebody is able to do what needs to be done at that position, I'm all for anybody getting an opportunity to do that. And it's definitely refreshing to see, like I said, that people are definitely a lot more open-minded, and there's really not much of a stigma. It's going to be nice. Eventually, I think it's going to get to a point where it's really not going to be that big of a deal for a woman to, you know, for a young lady, for example, to go out and kick a football. I saw a video a week ago. I can't remember where she was. I want to say, I think it was like Washington State, maybe, where they had a gal on the team and she was a starting quarterback. You know? 20 years ago, that would have not been fathomable. So, yeah, it's definitely refreshing to see the forward movement of our society and to see people being able to have opportunities to excel.
I want to change gears for a second, Scott, and talk about the Indianapolis Colts. A couple years back, they did you a huge solid. They gave you these specialized eyeglasses that allowed you to see the game in Lucas Oil Stadium like you've never seen it before. What was that experience like?
Beyond awesome. I had been in Lucas Oil Stadium, you know, plenty of times before that, but even with a pair of binoculars, it certainly was not anywhere near as good of an experience as being able to see the Eastsight glasses, which that's the name of the company. They're based out of Toronto. To be able to actually see 2020 and be able to see a football game, like the majority of people, first and foremost, that was absolutely wonderful and something that I never fathomed, you know, what happened. My mom, rest her soul, used to call the government hospital over in Bethesda, Maryland to ask, you know, is there something specific to my problem that they've been able to research? How close are we getting? The answer was always no. And then when those glasses, when I was able to get a hold of those glasses, even for the Colts game, I remember doing a demonstration and my jaws about hit the ground. They had me do an eye chart and I was able to see 2020. But getting back to the Colts game, it was absolutely breathtaking. The Colts could have not treated me any better. Got to deliver the game ball to the referees before the game. Sat one row from the field. In fact, I believe on Eastsight's YouTube, there's a video of me being able to celebrate a game-winning touchdown that Andrew Luck had thrown to Jack Doyle to win the game against Jacksonville. But just being able to take in all the sights, you know, things that people take for granted. I mean, it sounds kind of dorky, I guess, but being able to see things like the signage from the stadium from afar and not having to ask, well, what does that say on the scoreboard? Or, you know, what player is that over there? To be able to actually take all of that in. And then, you know, the Colts absolutely made me feel like I was a part of the team and I've been a lot to me.
That is awesome, man. I am so glad that you got to experience that. That was such a great moment for you. I actually saw that YouTube video that you're referring to, and I got to tell you, the expressions on your face when you were seeing the game in a whole new light was priceless. It was so amazing to get to see your reactions to everything that was unfolding before you. I got to tell you, everything that you're describing just now, I think those are images that the average NFL fan, or even myself, probably take for granted when we go to an NFL game. You know, getting to see the scoreboard, the field, the crowds, those are images that we're just accustomed to. Now, I want to bring up one of the stories that Scott showed us in his dorm room that night back in college 20 years ago. The film crew for that story blurred their cameras when they were showing some video in that story. And they did that to illustrate that is how Scott sees the world every day. Imagine what it would be like for you to wake up every morning and see the world like that every day. Despite that, Scott has never let that stop him, it has never hindered him, and it doesn't define him. Scott, it has been such a thrill to hear you tell the story of your journey. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. If someone is listening to this conversation right now, let's say hypothetically there's somebody who's got a vision impairment or they have any other kind of disability that might hinder them from playing sports, but they still want to give it a shot, what would you say to them?
I think first, a few things. Yes, it's always good to try something new. I do think you have to be a little bit realistic in what it is that you're doing. For example, obviously, if you're legally blind, you're not going to try out for baseball. You're not going to be able to see a 90-mile-an-hour fastball with the right bite. If you want to play something else and you know that, you know, for example, you're able to see the ball or something that doesn't take a whole heck of a lot of eyesight, then I would say go all for it. You know, I'm all for going for it. I would also tell you sports did so many things for me. It's not just being able to go and take an extra point. A lot of the lessons that you learn, it's a lot of things that you do in practice where, you know, for example, you're crawling in practice. You're doing bullets or suicides where you're starting from, you know, running it or bear crawling or whatever it is from point A to point B, and point B might be the 50-yard line, and it's 90 degrees out there in the middle of summertime, and your first reaction is, oh man, I don't want to do this. And then you do it and do it and do it and do it. And then you start thinking, oh my gosh, if I can do something like this, there's obviously other things that I can conquer. I would just tell people, you know, give it an opportunity. Again, be realistic. But if you have a passion for something, and I don't care if it's sports related or it's anything else, if you have a passion for it, give it a try. Don't let anybody stand in your way. Again, I do think people are a lot more open-minded now than they were 20-some-odd years ago. And just have fun with it, and you know, and also appreciate it if you're able to play a sport, especially at the high school level, because that time does go by really quick.
Scott, always good to catch up with you. Thank you so much for making the time on this edition of A Duff Said.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure to be here, and hopefully you inspired some people today.
My thanks to Scott Reese for being on this edition of A Duff Said. Remember, you can listen to previous editions of this podcast by going to dufftyler.podbean.com. Episode 11 will be dropping next week, so be sure to listen for that. Until then, if Duff said it, it must be true, because that's what a Duff said.